Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. We begin our program, as we usually do, with some daily selections from Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living. And again, the theme for this month is Glow Up. And the daily guides are from Ernest Holmes, with comments by the Reverend Dr. Jesse Jennings. Good belongs to all. There is such a thing as the habit of success. The awareness of power grows with use. Frederick Bales. I believe we should expect to have the good we want when we want it, and as much of it as we can take and use, knowing that nothing is stored up in this life outside of a state of consciousness. It has no bounds. It is not that we desire to possess, but to have access to the substance that shall flow continuously as supply to meet every need. That is wealth. We do not need more physical strength than we need to live, but to have access to such an abundance of vitality that while we are here, we shall have physical strength to manifest that vitality. That is health. There is no individual good. Good belongs to everyone. The watchword is not exclusion, but inclusion. And the more good we loose, the more good we experience. We are all parts of one tremendous whole whose nature is of God, of spirit, of the universe. It is in this divine nature, this inevitable union, that we should consciously walk and talk with the infinite until it becomes dynamic and real and peoples our life on earth with the images of its kingdom. And this is from Know Yourself, 1936, page 58. Often unstated in prosperity teachings is that the desire to acquire wealth and possessions and to pile them up can be driven by compulsion and greed. What we ought to actually and healthily seek, Holmes suggests, is a flow of supply through us. Perhaps this appears in the shape of money to then convert into the tools of our art. Perhaps it skips that step and just shows up as the tools. Sometimes a demonstration is finding the means to tackle a problem, and sometimes it's the problem evaporating. Affirmation. I rightly accomplish and prosper as I persistently keep my desires in accord with God's nature. And another one, also entitled Good Belongs to All. When we treat correctly, we treat for what we want, not for what we want to get rid of. We live in the answer. Aaron Mohn. The creative energy of spirit must be limitless. Therefore, we can set no limit to the possibility of what it can do for us. Undoubtedly, it is able to give us infinitely more than we have expected, understood, or accepted. We must believe that it will not only make the gift, it will also, out of its own energy, out of its own power, out of its own being, create the way, the method, and the means through which the gift is to come to us. This is the reality prayer deals with. Infinite in its possibility, ever ready to respond, the creative spirit awaits our recognition. We must learn to have faith, to walk in the light. Wherever people meet together for prayer and spiritual communion, a field of faith is created that reacts on everyone who enters it. An atmosphere of reality has been recognized. A new vibratory law has been set in motion. It is easy to break one twig, but if we bind many twigs together, they become unbreakable. In group consciousness, the individual faith of each member is strengthened through union with all the others. And this is from Pray and Prosper, 1974, pages 32-31. If one with God is a majority, many people combined in intention constitute a supermajority. We've all probably read about the effects of group prayer and may have engaged in it among our circles of loved ones. Now we realize that all good is collective, just as a rising tide lifts all boats. Even before any overt prayer results materialize, the group experience supports our sense of community, being welcomed and valued as indispensable to life. We are each a pillar in the temple. Affirmation. I now allow the divine wholeness to flow through me in ever-widening circles of activity. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, joy. My joy overflows, uplifting everyone it touches. Joy is one of my divine gifts, a part of me throughout all the seasons of life. Even amidst more challenging times, I can still access joy by finding it all around me. Whether in the simplicity of a sunset or in the depth of love I feel for a child, when I open my heart to my indwelling joy, I am aligning with Spirit's beautiful energy. The waters of joy replenish and restore all they touch, like flowers perking up after a rain. Invigorated and nourished, I have even more to invest in what elicits my joy. The more I find enjoyment in life, the more joy I bring into the world. Joy colors my words and blesses my interactions, enriching the people and places I encounter. Inner peace. I claim peace in prayer and share it generously. Unity co-founder Charles Fillmore wrote, "It is the law of spirit that we must be that which we would draw to us. If we would have peace and harmony in our environment, we must establish it within ourselves." I want peace in my every interaction and circumstance, which means I must ground myself in the assurance that God, Spirit, the universe, is peace, and I am that peace and expression. In quiet confidence, I affirm these words after a restful interlude in the silence. Peace guides my thoughts and expresses through my words and my actions. I am kind. I smile. I am loving, positive, and joyful. I am the peace I want to see in the world. And from Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, talent. It is the world that is enlightened, and we who are intermittent. Like radios, we struggle through our static to receive wavelengths that are always there. And being human, we're unable to sustain the clarity necessary to apprehend the magic inherent in everything. So we vacillate from the extraordinary to the ordinary time and time again, and most of us blame the world. It is not surprising, then, that though we feel intermittently gifted, our gifts are ever-present. For if enlightenment stems from a clarity of being, then talent is no more than a clarity of doing, an embodied moment where spirit and hand are one. The chief obstacle to talent, then, is a lapse in being. It is not that people have no talent, but that we lack the clarity to uncover what it is and how it works. Talent, it seems, is energy waiting to be released through an honest involvement in life. But so many of us check whether we have power with the main switch off, the switch being risk, curiosity, passion, and love. With this in mind, happiness can simply be described as a satisfaction we feel when we are in ultimate accord, however briefly, in being and doing. In those unified moments, our purpose is life, and our talent is living it in its most immediate detail, be it drying the dishes, or raking the leaves, or washing the baby's hair. So when I can't find my purpose, I beg myself to sit in a field in the sun, watching ants, in hopes that I will meet my clarity. When I am convinced I have no gifts at all, I implore myself to search for the switch, to try something out of view, to gamble on what is remotely calling. When I lapse between comets, I try to watch fish swim and hear birds glide, while I trudge out of sync. And in a tremor of faith, I know if I don't try at all, it will all return as surely and swiftly as light fills a hole. Center yourself and bring to mind the last time you experienced your being and doing as one. It might have been while shoveling or gardening or listening to music. Breathe slowly and think of this ability to experience oneness, however briefly, as one of your talents. Try during your day to apply this talent once. We return to Science of Mind for Reverend Dr. Sonny Cantrell Smith's monthly column, Sacred Activism, Compassion to Action, How Spiritual Principles Guide Us. Federal budget proposals threaten to erode the social safety nets that support millions of Americans. In addition to affecting domestic programs, recent U.S. budget cuts significantly impacted global health and humanitarian efforts. The U.S. historically has been a major contributor to international aid, funding initiatives that combat diseases like HIV, AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis, and supporting maternal and child health programs worldwide. The principles of sacred activism and science of mind philosophy offer a compelling framework for compassionate and conscious engagement. These spiritual approaches emphasize the integration of inner transformation with outward action, urging individuals to respond to societal challenges with empathy, wisdom, and a commitment to justice. Recent budget proposals outline cuts encompassing areas such as health care, nutrition assistance, housing support, and education funding. The potential consequences include increased food insecurity, loss of health care coverage, housing instability, increased illness, early deaths, and diminished access to quality education. Food insecurity remains a pressing issue, exacerbated by proposed cuts to nutrition assistance programs. Addressing this challenge requires a multifaceted approach. Community support. Engaging in local efforts such as food drives, community gardens, and support for food banks. Advocacy. Encouraging policymakers to prioritize funding for programs that ensure access to nutritious food for all. Education. Raising awareness about the causes and consequences of food insecurity and promoting a collective sense of responsibility. Such policy shifts raise critical questions. Who are we leaving behind? How do we, as a society, uphold the dignity and well-being of all individuals, especially the most vulnerable? Sacred activism calls for a fusion of deep spiritual insight with committed action. It recognizes that true change arises when individuals act from a place of love, compassion, and inner awareness. In the face of policies that exacerbate inequality and suffering, sacred activism urges us to empathize, understand and share the feelings of those affected by social and economic injustices, engage, participate actively in efforts to address and rectify systemic issues, empower, support initiatives that lift up marginalized communities and promote equitable access to resources. Science of Mind teaches that our thoughts and beliefs shape our reality. By aligning with universal principles of love, peace, and wholeness, individuals can co-create a more just and compassionate society. Ernest Holmes emphasized the importance of recognizing the divine presence in all people and circumstances, advocating for a life that reflects spiritual truths through positive action. Applying this philosophy to current challenges involves cultivating a deep understanding of the interconnectedness of all life, setting purposeful goals that align with the values of compassion and justice, and taking steps that reflect a commitment to the well-being of others, particularly those facing adversity. Integrating the principles of sacred activism and science of mind compels us to respond to societal challenges with spiritual insight and practical action. As we confront the implications of budget cuts on vulnerable populations, we are called to examine our own beliefs and behaviors, ensuring they align with values of compassion and equity, and build relationships across communities, emphasizing understanding and solidarity. We can also advocate for policies that reflect our collective commitment to human dignity. Through conscious awareness and compassionate action, we can contribute to a society that honors the inherent worth of every individual, ensuring that no one is left behind. And from the same issue, an article by Joseph Nelson and Daryl Prince, Lifelong Forgiveness, A Path to Spiritual Liberation. Forgiveness is not a one-time act. Forgiveness is a sacred, ongoing journey that liberates us from emotional bondage and realigns us with the divine presence within. As students of Science of Mind, we know healing begins in consciousness. As we forgive, we align our thinking with spiritual truth and awaken to the wholeness, peace, and freedom already inherent in our being. Forgiveness is a process of healing and spiritual recovery. It frees us from guilt, shame, resentment, and blame, energies that cloud our perceptions and constrict our hearts. When we choose to forgive, we loosen the grip of past pain and open ourselves to transformation. Forgiveness is not about forgetting or condoning what occurred, but rather is about reclaiming our power by releasing our emotional attachment to the experience. Why we forgive? Why forgive? Because it is through our forgiveness that we reclaim our birthright of personal freedom, our intended and natural state. Not forgiving binds us to the very hurt we wish to escape. Forgiveness, on the other hand, dissolves the emotional charge that would otherwise define us by our past. Forgiveness is not the same as resignation. It is not about accepting injustice or denying the reality of pain. It is a conscious decision to release resentment and bitterness so we no longer define ourselves or limit our experiences based on what happened in the past. And because life inevitably brings moments of hurt, misunderstanding, and conflict, forgiveness is not a single event. It is a lifelong spiritual practice. As Ernest Holmes wrote in Words That Heal Today, there must be a continual state of forgiveness, else there will be a continual state of unforgiveness. He also reminds us that self-forgiveness is just as essential. Our inability to forgive others blocks us, Our inability to forgive ourselves provides an equal block, and we cannot feel that we are forgiven until first we have forgiven others. The forgiveness triangle: acceptance, surrender, release. While countless books and programs exist on the subject, most forgiveness methodologies share common threads. Among them are the spiritual tools of acceptance and surrender. These, together with forgiveness, form what we call the forgiveness triangle. Acceptance involves acknowledging what happened and giving ourselves permission to feel the emotions it stirred: grief, anger, confusion, or betrayal. Rather than bypassing or suppressing these feelings, we allow them to rise, be witnessed, and then released. Without this honest reckoning, forgiveness cannot take root. Surrender follows acceptance and leads to the third part of the triangle. This is the moment when we choose to release the burden, to let go of the need for retribution or wishing the past had been different. Surrender is not passivity. It is instead deep spiritual strength. Surrender says, "I will no longer carry this pain." In surrender, we release and create space for grace to enter. Seeing with spiritual eyes. Perception plays a central role in forgiveness. How we choose to view the one who caused us pain, whether as an enemy or as a fellow traveler on the path, can determine whether we heal or remain stuck. Forgiveness expands our vision, inviting us to see through spiritual eyes. Research supports this. Dr. Fred Luskin's Stanford Forgiveness Project, the largest of its kind, invited participants to reframe those who harmed them as flawed, wounded human beings, rather than as villains or monsters. This shift led to greater peace, reduced stress, lowered blood pressure, and improved relationships. Luskin's findings demonstrate that forgiveness can be cultivated through intention, spiritual practice, and guided reflection. In their work, The Book of Forgiving, Archbishop Desmond Tutu and his daughter, Reverend Mofoa Tutu, describe the fourfold path of forgiveness, which includes recognizing the humanity in the one who harmed us. This opens the door to empathy and restores connection. Similarly, Colin Tipping's Radical Forgiveness teaches that those who wound us may be spiritual collaborators, mirrors revealing what within us is yet to be healed. This approach invites us to shift from victimhood into empowerment and grace without excusing the actions themselves. Practical tools for the forgiveness journey. Forgiveness often brings buried emotions to the surface. Trauma, shame, anger, and sadness may arise. These are not obstacles. They are invitations to deeper healing. Forgiveness must never be forced. It is a choice made willingly and with compassion. To support that choice, we can engage with the following spiritual tools rooted in science of mind principles. Visualization. Use the power of imagination to symbolically release pain. For example, during meditation, you might visualize anxiety as a balloon that deflates with each breath until it disappears, symbolizing release. Writing. Writing helps clarify emotions and open space for healing. Letters, whether sent, burned, or saved, can facilitate forgiveness of ourselves or others. Journaling provides a private space where we can be honest while we process our thoughts and examine our perspectives. Spiritual mind treatment, affirmative prayer. Use treatment to affirm healing and spiritual truth. Declare, "I am whole, I am free, I am no longer bound by the past." This shifts our mental patterns and aligns our consciousness with divine freedom. Meditation. A quiet mind is fertile ground for forgiveness. Meditation helps still reactive thought patterns and cultivates a consciousness of peace. Affirmations. Reading simple, powerful statements such as, "I forgive and release all," or "I am free from the past," helps refocus our mind toward liberation. Working with a licensed spiritual practitioner, therapist, or support group can bring compassionate guidance when forgiveness feels especially difficult. Lifelong spiritual practice. In a recent 4-week forgiveness workshop at CSL Santa Rosa, Reverend Dr. Edward Viljon emphasized that forgiveness is a lifelong discipline, not a one-time fix, but a way of living with an open heart. He encouraged participants to focus not on reliving the past, but on embracing today's opportunities, all while maintaining healthy boundaries. He suggested this daily affirmation: "I live in freedom and peace, unburdened by the past. This is a beautiful reminder of the peace forgiveness makes possible. Choose freedom. Forgiveness is not a destination. It is a spiritual journey that asks for our courage, our willingness, and our love. It is the process by which we move from pain to peace, from bondage to freedom. Through acceptance, surrender, and the recognition of our shared humanity, we dismantle the walls that separate us from ourselves and from others. Ultimately, forgiveness is an act of love. It is a return to wholeness. In choosing to forgive, we choose life, fully, freely, and in alignment with the divine. We turn now to the September-October 2025 issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and to Sylvia Hayes' monthly column, Sacred Earth Connections, Falling into Divinity. In Earth's northern hemisphere, fall is arriving with a painter's flair, splashing crimson and gold across the landscape. Days grow shorter, the light softer, the air crisper. Trees transform into blazing towers of bronze and scarlet. Fields and orchards offer up an abundance of fruits, grains, and vegetables. Of all the seasons, each with unique splendor, autumn perhaps most clearly reveals the divinity and glory woven through all of nature, of which we humans are a part. I was not taught to think of myself as divine. In fact, I was raised in a family and community that believed God was an out-there, judgmental, and sometimes punitive super-being, and we humans were all born sinners, eternally flawed, at least until we died, and hopefully made it to a heaven up there somewhere. I didn't find this to be a very empowering worldview, but rather a psychological mind-bender that took decades of therapy and soul-searching to move through. One of the greatest gifts of my lifetime has been having the courage to release those programmed beliefs. That's not easy to do, for those who are taught such action would likely lead to eternal damnation in a fiery hell. Releasing old programming, fear-entrenched beliefs, and even our familiar self-identity is like our own personal metaphysical autumn. We shed layers, not knowing what will replace them, and stand naked, quivering for a time between seasons. In autumn, trees, once verdant and full, shed their leaves, surrendering what is no longer useful to survival. It's an act not of death, but of preparation, a sacred conservation of energy that readies them for a more resilient life in the months to come. This remarkable act of letting go demonstrates a divine wisdom that renewal requires release. Fall invites us to similar sacred work, the work of discernment, of letting go of the mental clutter, physical distractions, and spiritual illusions that no longer serve our highest purpose. Just as the tree knows it must shed its leaves to preserve strength for winter and to prepare for new life in spring, so too must we drop the beliefs and behaviors that sap our vitality and hinder our becoming. And akin to wise trees, we too carry within us the capacity to do exactly that. Into the new clearing our divinity rises. Wonderfully, there's no need to grieve the old aspects of ourselves that fall away or bemoan how long it took. The forest floor becomes a canvas of fallen glory, where decomposition begins its quiet work, converting the old into nutrients for new growth. This cyclical nature of creation, destruction, and rebirth echoes through all spiritual traditions. The Hindu concept of Brahman, the divine reality that permeates all existence, is perfectly demonstrated in autumn's progressions, where nothing truly dies, but merely changes form, contributing to the greater whole. All that we release is perfect fodder and food for the unfolding recognition of our innate divinity, our true selves. Do you see the splendor, the divinity of creation all around you? Do you recognize that you are a unique and beautiful thread essential to the sacred tapestry? Nature, of which you are a part, isn't bashful about displaying, even embodying, splendor. What about you? Action idea. Be a little messier. In the fall, many insects, including those that help pollinate or eat pests like aphids, burrow into old plant stalks as a safe space and sometimes a food source. consider waiting until spring, after you start seeing flying insects in your yard, to clean out the old stalks, then compost them into new nutrients. Sylvia Hayes, spelled C-Y-L-V-I-A-H-A-Y-E-S, is a speaker, author, and Unity minister. Her Substack, Transcend, is about raised consciousness, economic system change, and a world that works better for all. She's also the former First Lady of Oregon. Visit sylviahayes.com. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you are currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. We continue now with the Book of Joy, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, with Douglas Abrams. And Douglas Abrams kind of guides the conversation and asks questions at times. We had started day one, the nature of true joy. And we pick up with Douglas asking, is joy a feeling that comes and surprises us, or is it a more dependable way of being, I asked. For the two of you, joy seems to be something much more enduring. Your spiritual practice hasn't made you somber and serious. It's made you more joyful. So how can people cultivate that sense of joy as a way of being and not just a temporary feeling? The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama looked at each other, and the Archbishop gestured to the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama squeezed the Archbishop's hand and began, "Yes, it is true. Joy is something different from happiness. When I use the word happiness, in a sense, I mean satisfaction. Sometimes we have a painful experience, but that experience, as you've said with birth, can bring great satisfaction and joyfulness." "Let me ask you," the Archbishop jumped in. "You've been in exile 56 years from a country that you love more than anything else. Why are you not morose?" "Morose?" the Dalai Lama asked, not understanding the word. As Jinpa hurried to translate morose into Tibetan, the Archbishop clarified, "Sad." The Dalai Lama took the Archbishop's hand in his, as if comforting him, while reviewing these painful events. The Dalai Lama's storied discovery as the reincarnation of the Dalai Lama meant that at the age of 2, he was swept away from his rural home in the Amdo province of eastern Tibet to the 1,000-room Potala Palace in the capital city of Lhasa. There he was raised in opulent isolation as the future spiritual and political leader of Tibet and as a godlike incarnation of Bodhisattva of compassion. After the Chinese invasion of Tibet in 1950, the Dalai Lama was thrust into politics. At the age of 15, he found himself the ruler of 6 million people and facing an all-out and desperately unequal war. For 9 years, he tried to negotiate with communist China for his people's welfare and sought political asylum as the country came to be annexed. In 1959, during an uprising that risked resulting in a massacre, the Dalai Lama decided with a heavy heart to go into exile. The odds of successfully escaping to India were frighteningly small, but to avoid a confrontation and a bloodbath, he left in the night dressed as a palace guard. He had to take off his recognizable glasses, and his blurred vision must have heightened his sense of fear and uncertainty as the escape party snuck by garrisons of the People's Liberation Army. They endured sandstorms and snowstorms as they summited 19,000-foot mountain peaks during their 3-week escape. "One of my practices comes from an ancient Indian teacher," the Dalai Lama began answering the Archbishop's question. "He taught that when you experience some tragic situation, think about it. If there's no way to overcome the tragedy, then there's no use worrying too much. So I practice that." The Dalai Lama was referring to the 8th century Buddhist master Shantideva, who wrote, "If something can be done about the situation, what need is there for dejection? And if nothing can be done about it, what use is there for being dejected?" The Archbishop cackled, perhaps because it seemed almost too incredible that someone could stop worrying just because it was pointless. "Yes, but I think people know it with their head." He touched both index fingers to his scalp. "You know that it doesn't help worrying, but they still worry. Many of us have become refugees, the Dalai Lama tried to explain, and there are a lot of difficulties in my own country. When I look only at that, he said, cupping his hands into a small circle, then I worry. He widened his hands, breaking the circle open. But when I look at the world, there are a lot of problems, even within the People's Republic of China. For example, the Hui Muslim community in China has a lot of problems and suffering. And then outside China, there are many more problems and more suffering. When we see these things, we realize that not only do we suffer, but so do many of our human brothers and sisters. So when we look at the same event from a wider perspective, we will reduce the worrying and our own suffering. I was struck by the simplicity and profundity of what the Dalai Lama was saying. This was far from "Don't worry, be happy," as the popular Bobby McFerrin song says. This was not a denial of pain and suffering, but a shift in perspective from oneself and toward others, from anguish to compassion, seeing that others are suffering as well. The remarkable thing about what the Dalai Lama was describing is that as we recognize others' suffering and realize that we are not alone, our pain is lessened. Often we hear about another's tragedy and it makes us feel better about our own situation. And this is quite different from what the Dalai Lama was doing. He was not contrasting his situation with others, but uniting his situation with others, enlarging his identity, and seeing that he and the Tibetan people were not alone in their suffering. This recognition that we are all connected, whether Tibetan Buddhists or Hui Muslims, is the birth of empathy and compassion. I wondered how the Dalai Lama's ability to shift his perspective might relate to the adage, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. Was it truly possible to experience pain, whether the pain of an injury or an exile, without suffering? There is a sutra, or teaching of the Buddha, called the Salata Sutta, that makes a similar distinction between our feelings of pain and the suffering that comes as a result of our response to the pain. When touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed, ordinary person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught. So he feels two pains, physical and mental, just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow and right afterward were to shoot him with another one, so that he feels the pain of two arrows. It seems that the Dalai Lama was suggesting that by shifting our perspective to a broader, more compassionate one, we can avoid the worry and suffering that is the second arrow. Then another thing, the Dalai Lama continued, there are different aspects to any event. For example, we lost our own country and became refugees, but that same experience gave us new opportunities to see more things. For me personally, I had more opportunities to meet with different people, different spiritual practitioners like you, and also scientists. This new opportunity arrived because I became a refugee. If I remained in the Potala in Lhasa, I would have stayed in what has often been described as a golden cage, the Lama, Holy Dalai Lama. He was now sitting up stiffly as he once had to when he was the cloistered spiritual head of the Forbidden Kingdom. So, personally, I prefer the last 5 decades of refugee life. It's more useful, more opportunity to learn, to experience life. Therefore, if you look from one angle, you feel, oh, how bad, how sad. But if you look from another angle at that same tragedy, that same event, you see that it gives me new opportunities. So it's wonderful. That's the main reason that I'm not sad and morose. There's a Tibetan saying, wherever you have friends, that's your country. And wherever you receive love, that's your home. There was an audible gasp in the room at this poignant saying, and at its ability to ease, if not erase, the pain of a half century spent in exile. That's very beautiful, the Archbishop said. Also, the Dalai Lama continued, whoever gives you love, that's your parent. So I consider you, although you are only 4 years older than me, as my father. I think you never could have had your children at the age of 4, so you are not my real father, but I do consider you as a father. What you said is quite wonderful, the Archbishop began, still clearly moved by the Dalai Lama's response to exile. I think I would just add to it by saying to our sisters and brothers out there, anguish and sadness in many ways are things that you cannot control. They happen. Supposing somebody hits you, the pain causes an anguish in you and an anger, and you might want to retaliate. But as you grow in the spiritual life, Whether as a Buddhist or a Christian or any other tradition, you are able to accept anything that happens to you. You accept it not as a result of your being sinful, that you are blameworthy because of what has happened. It's part of the warp and woof of life. It's going to happen whether you like it or not. There are going to be frustrations in life. The question is not, how do I escape? It is, how can I use this as something positive? Just as you, Your Holiness, have just described. Nothing, I think, can be more devastating in many ways than being turfed out of your own country. And a country is not just a country. I mean, it is a part of you. You are a part of it in a way that is very difficult to describe to other people. By rights, the Dalai Lama should be a sourpuss. The Dalai Lama asked Jinpur for a translation of sourpuss. The Archbishop decided to explain it himself. It's when you do that face. He was pointing at the Dalai Lama's quizzical expression and pursed lips, which did look a little like he had bitten into a lemon. Just that face, just like that. You look like a real sourpuss. The Dalai Lama was still trying to understand how one's puss could look sour, and Jinpur was still trying to translate. And then when you smile, your face lights up. And it is because, in a very large measure, you have transmuted what would have been totally negative. You've transmuted it into goodness. Because, again, you have not said, well, how can I be happy? You've not said that. You've said, how can I help to spread compassion and love? And people everywhere in the world, even when they don't understand your English, they come and they fill stadiums. I'm not really jealous. I speak far better English than you, and I don't get so many people coming to hear me as they come to you. And you know what? I don't think they come to listen. They may be doing that a bit. What they've come for is that you embody something, which they feel, because some of the things that you say, in a sense, are obvious. Yet it's not the words. It's the spirit behind those words. It is when you sit and you tell people that suffering, frustration, are not the determinants of who we are. It is that we can use these things that are seemingly negative for a positive effect. And I hope we can convey to God's children out there how deeply they are loved, how deeply, deeply precious they are to this God. Even the despised refugee whose name no one seems to know. I look frequently at pictures of people fleeing from violence, and there's so much of it. Look at the children. I say that God is crying because that is not how God wanted us to live. But you see again, even in those circumstances, you have these people who come from other parts of the world to try to help, to make things better. And through the tears, God begins to smile. And when God sees you and hears how you try to help God's children, God smiles. The Archbishop was now beaming, and he whispered the word smile as if it were the holy name of God. He wants to ask another question, the Archbishop said, seeing that I was leaning forward. It was extraordinary to hear how deeply they were engaging with joy and suffering. But at the rate we were going, we wouldn't get through one-tenth of the questions we needed to ask. The Dalai Lama slapped the Archbishop's hand and said, "We have several days, so it's not a problem. If our interview is only 30 minutes or 1 hour, then we have to shorten our answers." "You must shorten your answers," the Archbishop said. "I am brief. First, let's have tea, and then I will be brief." Nothing beautiful comes without some suffering. Archbishop, you were talking about how the Dalai Lama has experienced great suffering in his exile. During apartheid, you and your country experienced great suffering too. And even in your personal life, you've dealt with prostate cancer. You're dealing with it now. Many people, when they get ill, don't feel very joyful. You've been able to maintain that joy in the face of suffering. How have you been able to do it? Well, I have certainly been helped by many other people. One of the good things is realizing that you are not a solitary cell. You are part of a wonderful community. That's helped very greatly. As we were saying, if you are setting out to be joyful, you are not going to end up being joyful. You're going to find yourself turned in on yourself. It's like a flower. You open, you blossom, really because of other people. And I think some suffering, maybe even intense suffering, is a necessary ingredient for life, certainly for developing compassion. You know, when Nelson Mandela went to jail, he was young, and you could almost say bloodthirsty. He was head of the armed wing of the African National Congress, his party. He spent 27 years in jail, and many would say, 27 years? Oh, what a waste. And I think people are surprised when I say, no, the 27 years were necessary. They were necessary to remove the dross. The suffering in prison helped him to become more magnanimous, willing to listen to the other side, to discover that the people he regarded as his enemy, they too were human beings who had fears and expectations, and they had been molded by their society. And so without the 27 years, I don't think we would have seen the Nelson Mandela with the compassion, the magnanimity, the capacity to put himself in the shoes of the other. While the racist apartheid government in South Africa imprisoned Nelson Mandela and so many other political leaders, the Archbishop became the de facto ambassador of the anti-apartheid struggle. Protected by his Anglican robes and the Nobel Prize that he received in 1984, he was able to campaign for an end to the oppression of blacks and other people of color in South Africa. During that bloody struggle, he buried countless men, women, and children and tirelessly preached peace and forgiveness at their funerals. After the release of Nelson Mandela and his election as the first president of a free South Africa, the Archbishop was asked to create the famed Truth and Reconciliation Commission to try to find a peaceful way to confront the atrocities of apartheid and pioneer a new future without revenge and retribution. And in a kind of paradoxical way, the Archbishop continued, it is how we face all of the things that seem to be negative in our lives that determines the kind of person we become. If we regard all of this as frustrating, we're going to come out squeezed and tight and just angry and wishing to smash everything. When I spoke about mothers and childbirth, it seems to be a wonderful metaphor, actually, that nothing beautiful in the end comes without a measure of some pain, some frustration, some suffering. This is the nature of things. This is how our universe has been made up. Later, I was amazed to hear from prenatal researcher Patrick Wadhwa that there is indeed a kind of biological law at work in these situations. Stress and opposition turn out to be exactly what initiate our development in utero. Our stem cells do not differentiate and become us if there is not enough biological stress to encourage them to do so. Without stress and opposition, complex life like ours would never have developed. We would never have come into being. If you want to be a good writer, the Archbishop concluded, you are not going to become one by always going to the movies and eating bonbons. You have to sit down and write, which can be very frustrating, and yet without that, you would not get that good result. There was deep truth in what the Archbishop was saying, and yet I wanted to repeat back to him what he had said to the Dalai Lama. It's one thing to understand the value of suffering, and quite another to remember it when you are angry or frustrated or in pain. Archbishop, take us with you to the hospital or to a doctor's appointment, and they're probing you and prodding you, and it's painful and it's uncomfortable, and you're waiting, and it takes a long time. What do you do inside yourself not to feel angry or to complain or to wallow in your self-pity? It sounds like you're saying you can choose to be joyful even in the face of that difficulty. How do you do that? I think we ought not to make people feel guilty when it is painful. It is painful, and you have to acknowledge that it is painful. But actually, even in the midst of that pain, you can recognize the gentleness of the nurse who is looking after you. You can see the skill of the surgeon who is going to be performing the operation on you. Yet sometimes the pain can be so intense that you do not have even the capacity to do that. The thing is, don't feel guilty. We have no control over our feelings. Emotions are spontaneous things that arise. This was a point that the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama would disagree on during the week. How much control do we have over our emotions? The Archbishop would say we have very little. The Dalai Lama would say we have more than we think. At some point, you will be in anguish, the Archbishop continued. We are told in the Christian tradition to offer up our suffering and unite it with the anguish and pain of our Savior, and thus use it to improve the world. It does help you not to be too self-centered. It helps you to some extent to look away from yourself, and it can help make that anguish bearable. You don't have to be a believer in any faith to be able to say, oh, aren't I blessed that I have doctors, that I have nurses qualified to look after me, and that I can be in a hospital? That might just be the beginning of moving away from being so self-centered and concentrating too much on me, 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 me. you begin to realize, hey, I'm not alone in this. Look at all the many others, and there may be some who are in greater pain. It's like being put into a fiery furnace to be refined. The Dalai Lama jumped in to affirm the truth of what the Archbishop was saying. Too much self-centered thinking is the source of suffering. A compassionate concern for others' well-being is the source of happiness. I do not have as much experience with physical pain as you have. Yet one day I was in Bodh Gaya, the place where the Buddha achieved enlightenment, to begin a series of important Buddhist teachings. Bodh Gaya is the holiest pilgrimage place for Buddhists. There were around 100,000 people who had come to attend the teachings, but suddenly I had intense pain in my abdomen. They did not know then that it was my gallbladder, but I was told I needed to go to the hospital urgently. When bouts of pain struck, it was so intense that I was sweating. We had to drive to the hospital in Patna, the capital city of the state of Bihar, which was 2 hours away. As we were driving along the road, we passed a lot of poverty. Bihar is one of the poorest states in India. I could see out the window that the children had no shoes, and I knew that they were not getting a proper education. Then, as we approached Patna, under a hut I saw an old man lying on the ground. His hair was disheveled, his clothes were dirty, and he looked sick. He had no one to take care of him. Really, he looked as if he were dying. All the way to the hospital, I was thinking of this man and felt his suffering, and I completely forgot about my own pain. By simply shifting my focus to another person, which is what compassion does, my own pain was much less intense. This is how compassion works, even at the physical level. So, as you rightly mentioned, a self-centered attitude is the source of the problem. We have to take care of ourselves without selfishly taking care of ourselves. If we don't take care of ourselves, we cannot survive. We need to do that. We should have wise selfishness rather than foolish selfishness. Foolish selfishness means you just think only of yourself, don't care about others, bully others, exploit others. In fact, taking care of others, helping them, ultimately is the way to discover your own joy and to have a happy life. So that is what I call wise selfishness. You are wise, the Archbishop said. I wouldn't just say wise selfish. You are wise. The Buddhist practice of mind training, called Lojong in Tibetan, is an important part of the Dalai Lama's tradition. One of the fundamental messages in the original 12th century Lojong text echoes what the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were saying about looking away from oneself. All Dharma teachings agree on one point, lessening one's self-absorption. The text clarifies that when we focus on ourselves, we are destined to be unhappy. Contemplate that. As long as you are too focused on your self-importance and too caught up in thinking about how you are good or bad, you will experience suffering. Obsessing about getting what you want and avoiding what you don't want does not result in happiness. The text includes the admonition, always maintain only a joyful mind. So what then is this joyful mind? Jinpa, who wrote a translation and commentary on this revered text, explained as we were preparing for the trip that joy is our essential nature, something everyone can realize. We could say that our desire for happiness is, in a way, an attempt to rediscover our original state of mind. It seems that Buddhists believe that joy is the natural state, but that the ability to experience joy can also be cultivated as a skill. As we were hearing, so much depends on where we put our attention, on our own suffering or that of others, on our own perceived separation or on our indivisible connection. Our ability to cultivate joy has not been scientifically studied as thoroughly as our ability to cultivate happiness. In 1978, psychologists Philip Brickman, Dan Coates, and Ronnie Janoff Bowman published a landmark study that found that lottery winners were not significantly happier than those who had been paralyzed in an accident. From this and subsequent work came the idea that people have a set point that determines their happiness over the course of their life. In other words, we get accustomed to any new situation and inevitably return to our general state of happiness. However, more recent research by psychologist Sonia Lyubomirsky suggests that perhaps only 50% of our happiness is determined by immutable factors like our genes, our temperament, our set point. The other half is determined by a combination of our circumstances, over which we may have limited control, and our attitudes and actions, over which we have a great deal of control. According to Lyubomirsky, the three factors that seem to have the greatest influence on increasing our happiness are our ability to reframe our situation more positively, our ability to experience gratitude, and our choice to be kind and generous. These were exactly the attitudes and actions that the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop had already mentioned, and to which they would return as central pillars of joy. Have you renounced pleasure? Most religions have a strong conviction that we cannot discover lasting happiness through our senses. So while temporary enjoyment can come through our senses, it is inevitably fleeting and not the source of enduring satisfaction. There's a Buddhist saying that trying to seek happiness through sensory gratification is like trying to quench your thirst by drinking salt water. But what exactly is the relationship between joy and pleasure, and between what the Dalai Lama has called happiness at the physical level and happiness at the mental level? Your Holiness, many believe that as a monk you have renounced pleasure or enjoyment. And sex, the Dalai Lama added, although that was not exactly where I was going. What? The Archbishop said. Sex, the Dalai Lama repeated. Did you just say that? The Archbishop said incredulously. Oh, the Dalai Lama said with a laugh, noticing the Archbishop's surprise, and then reached over to reassure him, which caused the Archbishop to erupt in a gleeful cackle. So, aside from sex, I said, trying to bring us back, have you renounced pleasure and enjoyment? I sat next to you at lunch, and it looked like you were really enjoying the wonderful food. What is the role for you of enjoying the pleasures of life? I love food. Without food, my body can't survive. You also, he said, turning to the Archbishop, can't just think God, God, God. I cannot just think about compassion, compassion, compassion. Compassion will not fill my stomach. But you see, each meal we have to develop the ability to consume the meal without attachment. Huh? The Archbishop asked, not quite following how the Dalai Lama was using the Buddhist term attachment, and perhaps also not quite following how anyone could not be attached to one's food. Not eating out of greed, the Dalai Lama explained, eating only for the survival of the body. One must think about the deeper value of nourishing the body. At one of our meals, the Dalai Lama had showed me his bowl of Tibetan rice and yogurt pudding and said, "This is typical Tibetan monk's food. I love this." He was eating with relish. There was something deeply relieving about knowing that holiness didn't require a rejection of the simple joys of life, like a good meal and especially pudding. I felt pretty sure that he had gotten some significant amount of pleasure out of eating that dessert. He was clearly experiencing some joy through his senses. I wondered about the boundary between enjoyment and greed. Was it the second or third helping, and therefore a matter of portion size? Or was it a matter of attitude toward each bite? Jinpa shared with me a well-known Tibetan Buddhist prayer that often is said before a meal. Viewing this meal as a medicine, I shall enjoy it without greed or anger, not out of gluttony nor out of pride, not to fatten myself, but only to nourish my body. Perhaps the Dalai Lama was saying that eating to nourish the body did not require one to deny the enjoyment and satisfaction of the experience. So now to your question, the Dalai Lama said. When we speak of experiencing happiness, we need to know that there are actually two different kinds. The first is the enjoyment of pleasure through our senses. Here, sex, the example I cited, is one such experience. But we can also experience happiness at the deeper level through our mind, such as through love, compassion, and generosity. What characterizes happiness at this deeper level is a sense of fulfillment that you experience. While the joy of the senses is brief, the joy at this deeper level is much longer lasting. It is true joy. A believer develops this deeper level of joy through faith in God, which brings inner strength, inner peace. For a non-believer or a non-theist like me, we must develop this deeper level of joy through training the mind. This kind of joy or happiness comes from within. Then the pleasures of the senses become less important. Over the last several years, I have discussed with scientists this distinction between the sensory level of pleasure and pain and the deeper level of mental happiness and suffering. Now, if we look at today's materialistic life, people seem mainly concerned with sensory experiences. So that's why their satisfaction is very limited and brief, since their experience of happiness is so dependent on external stimuli. For example, so long as the music is playing, they feel happy. He tilted his head to the side with a smile, as if appreciating the music. When something good is happening, they are happy. Good food, they are happy. When these things stop, then they feel bored, restless, and unhappy. Of course, this is nothing new. Even in the time of the Buddha, people would fall into the trap of thinking that sensory experience would bring them happiness. So when joy arises at the level of your mind and not just your senses, you can maintain a deep sense of satisfaction for a much longer period of time, even for 24 hours. So I always say to people, you have to pay more attention to the mental level of joy and happiness, not just physical pleasure, but satisfaction at the level of mind. This is true joyfulness. When you are joyful and happy at the mental level, physical pain doesn't matter very much. But if there is no joy or happiness at the mental level, too much worrying, too much fear, then even physical comforts and pleasure will not soothe your mental discomfort. Many of our readers, I said, will understand what physical pleasure is, or the physical dimension of joy and happiness. They know how a good meal or a good song makes them feel. But what is this mental happiness or mental pleasure that you're talking about that lasts for 24 hours? A genuine sense of love and affection, the Dalai Lama said. Do you wake up with this joy, I asked, even before coffee? If you develop a strong sense of concern for the well-being of all sentient beings, and in particular all human beings, this will make you happy in the morning, even before coffee. This is the value of compassion, of having compassionate feelings for others. Even, you see, 10 minutes or 30 minutes of meditating on compassion, on kindness for others, and you will see its effects all day. That's the way to maintain a calm and joyous mind. Everyone has had the experience of being in a good mood and some trouble comes and you feel okay. When your mood is really bad, even when your closest friend comes, you still feel unhappy. Did you feel that way when I came? The Archbishop said playfully. That is exactly why I came to the airport to receive you, so I could feel more unhappy and make trouble for you. Well, we will continue with this in the coming weeks. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.